Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 117. It's October 13th, 2020. I want to repeat this until you are sick of hearing it. Networks do great harm by appearing enough like real communities to create expectations that they can manage human social and psychological needs. The reality is that they cannot. Even associations as inherently harmless as bridge clubs, chess clubs, amateur acting groups, or groups of social activists will, if they maintain a pretense of whole friendship, ultimately produce that odd sensation familiar to all city dwellers of being lonely in the middle of a crowd. Which of us who frequently networks has not felt this sensation? Belonging to many networks does not add up to having a community, no matter how many you belong to or how often your telephone rings. With a network, what you get at the beginning is all you ever get. Networks don't get better or worse. Their limited purpose keeps them pretty much the same all the time, as there just isn't much development possible. The pathological state, which eventually develops out of these constant repetitions of thin human contact, is a feeling that your friends and colleagues, in quotes, don't really care about you beyond what you can do for them, that they have no curiosity about the way you manage your life. No curiosity about your hopes, fears, victories, defeats. The real truth is that the friends falsely mourned for their indifference were never friends, just fellow networkers from whom, in fairness, little should be expected beyond attention to the common interest. But given our unquenchable need for community and the unlikelihood of obtaining that community in a network, we are so desperate for any solution that we are driven to deceive ourselves about the nature of those liaisons. Whatever caring really means, it means something more than simple companionship or even the comradeship of shared interests. In the growth of human society, families came first, community second, and only much later came the institutions set up by the community to serve it. Most institutional rhetoric, the proclaiming of what is important, borrows its values from those of individual families that work well together, particularly over the past century and a half in the United States. Spokesmen for institutional life have demanded a role above and beyond service to families and communities. They have sought to command and prescribe as kings used to do, though there is an important difference. In the case of ancient kings, once beyond the range of their voices and trumpets, you could usually do what you pleased. But in the case of modern institution, the reach of technology is everywhere. There is no escape if the place where you live and the family you live in cannot provide sanctuary. Institutions say their political philosophers are better at creating marching orders for the human race than families are. Therefore, they should no longer be expected to follow, but should lead. Institutional leaders have come to regard themselves as great synthetic fathers to millions of synthetic children, by which I mean to all of us. This theory sees us bound together in some abstract family relationship in which the state is the true mother and father. Hence, it insists on our first and best loyalty. Ask not, said President Kennedy, what your country can do for you, but rather ask what you can do for your country. Since the you in question is both real and human, and the country you are alleged to possess is one of the most extreme of verbal abstractions, it will readily be seen that the president's injunction is an expression of a synthetic family philosophy which regards a nation as possessing a claim superior to the claim of family. If you see nothing wrong with this, then it is probable you also believe that with a little tinkering, our schools will work just fine. But if you have a queer feeling about the image of yourself and your family as appendages of an abstraction, then we are on the same wavelength. In the latter case, we are ready to consider that we may need less school, not more. I want to examine the destructive effects of the false claim of institutional prerogative has on both individual and family life, a destructiveness equally profound, whether the claim comes from a government, a corporation, or some other form of network. If we return to our original discussion of networks, it will be clear that every one of our national institutions is a place where men, women, and children are isolated according to some limited aspect of their total humanity, by age and a few other considerations in the case of compulsory schooling, as well as by various other sorting mechanisms in other institutional arenas. If performance within these narrow confines is conceived to be the supreme measure of success, if, for instance, an A average is considered the central purpose of adolescent life, the requirements for which take most of the time and attention of the aspirant, and if the worth of the individual is reckoned by victory or defeat in this abstract pursuit, then a social machine has been constructed which, by attaching purpose and meaning to essentially meaningless and fantastic behavior, will certainly dehumanize students, alienate them from their own human nature, and break the natural connection between them and their parents, to whom they would otherwise look for significant affirmations. Welcome to the world of mass schooling, which sets this goal as its supreme achievement. Are you sure we want more of it? As we approach the 21st century, it is correct to say that the United States has become a nation of institutions, whereas it used to be a nation of communities. Large cities have great difficulty supporting healthy community life, partly because of the coming and going of strangers, partly because of space constrictions, partly because of poisoned environments, but mostly because of the constant competition of institutions and networks for the custody of children and old people, for monopolizing the time of everyone else in between. By isolating young and old from the working life of places, and by isolating the working population from the lives of young and old, institutions and networks have brought about a fundamental disconnection of the generations. The griefs that arise from this have no synthetic remedy, no vibrant, satisfying communities can come into being where young and old are locked away. Here and there, mutilated versions of communities struggle to survive, as in places where cultural homogeneity has been fiercely protected, such as in Bensonhurst in Brooklyn or Polish Hill in Pittsburgh. But in the main, community in cities and suburbs is a thin illusion, confined to simulated events like street festivals. If you have moved from one neighborhood to another, from one suburb to another, and have quickly forgotten the friends you left behind, then you will have experienced the phenomenon I refer to. Over 90% of the population of the United States now lives inside 50 urban aggregations, having been concentrated there as the end product of fairly well-understood historical processes. They are denied a reciprocal part in any continuous, well-articulated community. They are profoundly alienated from their own human interests. What else could it mean that only half of our eligible citizens are registered to vote, and that of those, a barely 50% do vote? In two-party jurisdictions, a trifle over one-eighth of the citizenry is thus sufficient to elect public officials, assuming the vote splits fairly evenly. We've come a long way down the road of redefining as an option what used to be regarded as a duty. But that is what alienation from community life quickly accomplishes: indifference to almost everything. When one is offered institutional simulations of community, a steady diet of networks, involuntary like schools or voluntary like isolated workplaces divorced from human variety, basic human needs are placed in the gravest jeopardy, a danger magnified many times in the case of children. Institutional goals, however sane and well-intentioned, are unable to harmonize deeply with the uniqueness of individual human goals. No matter how good the individuals who manage an institution are, institutions lack a conscience because they measure by accounting methods. Institutions are not the sum total of their personnel or even of their leadership, but are independent of both and will exist after management has been completely replaced. They are ideas come to life, ideas in whose service all employees are but servo mechanisms. The deepest purposes of these gigantic networks are to regulate and to make uniform. Since the logic of family and community is to give scope to variety around a central theme, whenever institutions intervene significantly in personal affairs, they cause much damage. By redirecting the focus of our own lives from families and communities to institutions and networks, we, in effect, anoint a machine our king. All right, I'll stop there. That is a bit more of John Taylor Gatto's We Need Less School, Not More. I think, if memory serves, I backed up just a little, half a page or a page, over a section I had read prior. That's okay. It's a decent tethering if any of you happen to have been along for the ride back then. If not, you can go to regular.fm/117, and there'll be a tag for John Taylor Gatto. And you can go back and listen to some of this other stuff, and I highly recommend The 7-Lesson School Teacher as well. And I'll link to this book, the book it came from, called Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, which collects several of his essays. He's now deceased, and you can tell from the reading that This was written in the latter part of the 20th century, sometime in the early 90s, I think. And it's really got me thinking, networks versus communities, the usefulness of networks, but their narrow purpose, and how we have made a big mistake in seeking community from networks, how we're over-networked and under-communityed, and how it's reducing us to use value among each other. That kind of stuff, use value among each other, that's great. It's trade. It's specialization. It's an economy. But there's a whole lot that happens outside of that, or should. And it's interesting, too, to think about things like so-called social networks, news networks, that Gatto would use network as a term for bad things. Not inherently bad, but again, in the role in which we're expecting them to serve, they become bad. It's a real thinker, and it has me thinking too about how to foster real community and this idea of really knowing the other person. It does remind me of Dunbar's number and the studies there. I think there's Wikipedia articles I can link to. But it's the notion that to be an actual community, there's a limit. What's fascinating about the research is Dunbar and his compatriots, they didn't come up with the 150 to 250-ish as the number for community based on historical practice, though it is affirmed by a lot of historical practice. Things like military size of military units, and even going back to ancient times, and corporate structures and things. When a group reaches more than 150 people, they split it in two so that everybody inside the group can get to know the others. That is not how they came up with Dunbar's number. What they did is studied primates, and they pulled together studies that all kinds of others had done on primates. And there's a whole big discussion in one of the papers where what should be the measure, what should be the limiting factor, the size of whole brain, the neocortex, the relative size of the neocortex in the brain, these kinds of things, the processing power involved. And so what they do is they study all the primates' brain measurements and the size of their groups. And they create a formula and back into this relationship between the size of the neocortex in the brain and group size. And that is how they derived what's now been referred to as Dunbar's number, based on the size of the neocortex in human brains. Plug that into their formula, and it works out that, depending on how you look at it and which measurement of brain, et cetera, you're using, somewhere between 150 and 250 people, something like that. So it is derived based on anatomy and comparative anatomy across primates. Not something I realized when I heard the term. I thought it was more just sort of like casual empirical observation of group sizes and practices in humanity. They kind of foot to that stuff, but again, that's not how they come up with it. So that's interesting too, and we definitely move all over the place. We definitely do segregate by age all over the place, principally the old and the young. And so that's really interesting. I do think, meanwhile, during COVID, there's been quite a reshuffling of all of that, because more kids are in homes now than is typical in the fall, with more virtual schooling happening. And I think it's a lot is dawning on people. There's a lot of struggles. I don't know how everybody's dealing with it logistically, especially single parents or two parents are working with multiple kids. We have one child. We can do a little bit of zone defense. If you're a single parent with three kids, or, you know, two parents and you've got five or six kids, it must be a real challenge in so many levels. Just even bandwidth and computers and all of that, much less keeping everybody together and functional and moving forward. So, fascinating times. Hopefully, the disequilibrium here will represent an opportunity for entrepreneurs who, and sort of artists, I guess, of all kinds, who can reinvigorate community in new ways. And we can all shake free of this kind of institutional numbness, status quo that's calcified around us without our knowledge to see it now is fascinating. And some of this institutional decay, I mean, something as sort of basic and maybe cliche as The Wire. The Wire is such a fantastic series, 5 seasons, set in Baltimore, present day Baltimore, and institutional decay is on display. It also reminds me a lot of the writing and work of Clay Shirky. I'm not sure what he's up to as much in the last few years. His posts were always in a folder, my RSS feeds, of the stuff I wanted to make sure and read whenever it came out. And I feel like I've lost track of him. I don't know if he hopped from one engine to another and I lost the feed or something, but it makes me want to go looking back up again and bring some of his thinking to the party here about Web 2.0, I suppose. And also he's had a lot to say, if I remember, about institutions and how they invariably begin to preserve themselves, not necessarily to focus first on solving the problem they were ostensibly created for originally, but the new primary problem becomes continuing and expanding the existence of the institution itself. That is bad. That is not good. That sort of violates the creative destruction that you want in a market economy. If it's no longer necessary, you want it to go away. You want it to get more efficient. You want it, if possible, to serve its function with fewer resources, not more. Things like that. So Gatto's got a lot going on here that's really interesting. Networks can be really good. Isolating certain facets of life and connecting with others and that kind of thing can be very, very good. Exchanging use value and transactions can be very good. But something else is going on, this breakdown of community. I think he's right, even writing there in the 90s, that we all feel it. I don't know, he passed sometime in the last 10 years, I think. Could have been in the early 2000s, I lose track, but I wonder how much he had to say about social media, so-called Facebook, Twitter, and this kind of thing. Because they certainly seem to be soul-crushing in many respects. Wildly useful tools. It's wonderful, the access to information and immediate, direct sight into many parts of the world, formerly much more invisible. And yet, these tools also can bring out the worst of us. Makes me also want to get back, or not get back, but for the first time here, started getting into McLuhan and all that kind of stuff. So, really good stuff. Hopefully you're liking the Gatto stuff, and y'all have a good one. Talk with you tomorrow. Thanks a lot.